Lecture 8. The Silk Road, Classical Period Contacts.
This is a discussion about contacts among civilizations and regions during the Classical Period. Of all the discussions we're having about the classical world, this one is perhaps the discussion that would most please the pure world historian, because as we discussed in the first session, world historians love to talk about contact. I probably need to worry about my credentials, because while I will talk about contact, and while I think that the contacts we'll discuss clearly have historical significance, I'm also going to rain on the parade a little bit to mention that the contacts not only occurred, but occurred amid severe limitations. So, we're talking about two kinds of contacts involving several different patterns in each category. Contact first by means of trade. Contact first by means of direct juxtaposition between two civilizations. And we're talking about how these contacts need to be assessed in terms of the classical period itself and in terms of later legacies. Pretty obviously, the classical period rests primarily on integrations that occurred within large regions which we've come to call civilizations. In other words, the classical period is not defined by really local history, but by regional history and by patterns of connections that expanded those regions fairly systematically and in some cases very durably. But the contact that overlaid these regional integrations needs to be noted as well, while not overshadowing the regional picture itself. Regional focus remains primary. Contact is a significant overlay. Two major types of trade contacts developed during the classical period. The most famous one, and it's deservedly notorious, involved the contacts that went along what we've come to call the Silk Road, a nexus of trade routes that ran from Western China, usually through Central Asia across the northernmost reaches of the Himalayan mountains, into the Middle East through Persia, and sometimes beyond the Middle East on into the Mediterranean. Alternative routes would take some of this trade directly through India. The Silk Road is a nice label, but it is obviously important to recognize there was no single route, no nice highway markers. It's a pattern of Western Chinese to Middle Eastern to Mediterranean movement that we're focusing on here. The trade was romantic in many ways, at least as it has been recalled by historians and art historians. It took traders into a variety of ethnic settings, in Central Asia particularly. It involved frequently some direct interaction between merchants from established agricultural economies and nomadic traders. It's one of the ways in which the nomadic peoples of Central Asia played a direct role in world history through their contact, but also through their capacity to extend what people in the settled civilizations were interested in doing. It involved romantic designations in the along the way, such as the city of Samarkand, which I have never visited but would like to. It's a really interesting set of patterns. As the name implies, the good that was most important on this trade route was silk, manufactured in China, increasingly esteemed by people in the Middle East and even in the Mediterranean. By the time of the later Republic and particularly early Empire in Rome, it was fashionable for upper-class Romans, both men and women, to wear silk or silk adornments on their togas. This was obviously a prime luxury commodity. Flowing along the Silk Road also in the other direction were exotic animals, which the Romans were able to import from Africa, gold, slaves, a variety of goods that Westerners tried to use to match the important flow of manufactured products from China and, to a lesser extent, spices and food products from other points along the more easterly end of this chain. It's a terrific route to note. It's a favorite thing to ask about on world history tests, But we also need to ask what the significance was. Clearly, you can make a case that the Silk Road had at least a little bit of significance in terms of the economies and even more obviously the consumer patterns of some of the recipients of the trade. This is an example as we look at the increasing taste for silk. This is an example of the ways in which new patterns of world trade can feed new levels of consumer interest. The trade was undoubtedly economically important for some manufacturing centers in Western China and clearly important for the merchants involved. But I think it's fair to say that with these important significances noted, this is not a trade pattern that had deep significance for the economies of any of the major societies involved. It was an interesting addendum. It undoubtedly sustained some individual groups and peoples, but it wasn't an economic mainstay. Equally important, the trade proceeded in stages along the vast expanse of the Asian continent. Nobody, as far as we know, went the whole way. Romans were vaguely aware that China existed. They knew a lot about India, as we'll come to in a moment. They were vaguely aware that China existed. They tended to confuse it with silk itself and sometimes use the same word for both. We have no evidence, it's not impossible, but we have no evidence that anybody ever made it from the Mediterranean to China or vice versa. There's a possibility of a Chinese traveler, but no clear confirmation. The trade was in stages, which helps explain, along with the relatively light volume, why the Silk Road did not generate any particularly intense cultural exchanges or even technological exchanges. This is an interesting pattern of trade, not to be minimized, but also not to be exaggerated. A second nexus of trade, surprisingly robust, developed with India as its direct center. This involved trade from the Middle East and the Mediterranean, going directly to India, and also involved Chinese interest in direct trade with India. By the time of the Roman Empire, regular expeditions were mounted annually from the Red Sea to the subcontinent of India directly. Colonies of Roman merchants operated in some southern Indian cities. The key interest here was spices, such as pepper. But obviously, there was a sufficient trade to motivate some government encouragement. These were imperially organized expeditions. Some increased knowledge of the navigation patterns necessary to handle the wind routes on the Indian Ocean. And some direct involvement between the Mediterranean societies and Indian societies themselves. Chinese trade also reached India, not only overland along the Silk Roads, but through ocean-borne travel from the Pacific coast of China around to the Indian Ocean and to eastern India. At one point, for example, a Han emperor in China directly sent a ship to India seeking a rhinoceros for his personal zoo. So India is a second center of trade, and it reminds us again, as does the Silk Road, that classical civilizations did not operate in complete isolation from each other. They did increasingly learn the advantages of at least limited commercial outreach, and this outreach obviously tended to expand. There were some other trade routes that pressed beyond the boundaries of the classical civilizations themselves, as is pretty obvious from our earlier discussion of the patterns of Chinese tribute. China developed a fairly robust trade with places like Korea and Vietnam. India had probably the most extensive trade outreach of any of the societies. Our problem is the records here are not terribly elaborate. But Indian merchants, particularly from southern India, regularly traded with other parts of Southeast Asia, including present-day Indonesia. This is one of the reasons that pockets of Hinduism spread in these same directions, and this is another set of connections that's worthy of note. Mediterranean societies and Middle Eastern traders also developed contacts with certain parts of sub-Saharan Africa. We don't always know the specific means by which Romans, for example, acquired more exotic African animals, including lions, some of which were actually North African, but some of which were sub-Saharan. But clearly the Romans had means of contact with sub-Saharan peoples. Active trade connected Ethiopia in northeastern Africa with the Middle East and even points beyond in the Eastern Mediterranean. It was through these trade contacts that Ethiopians acquired knowledge of Judaism, and some Ethiopian conversions to Judaism occurred before or during the classical period. And later, obviously, Ethiopian Christianity reflected the same kinds of well-established commercial and cultural connections with the Mediterranean world. Obviously, then, the classical civilizations, along with their strong emphasis on patterns of internal trade and internal commercial integration and specialization, reached out for certain kinds of products, for certain kinds of opportunities, to a wider network that embraced territories beyond the classical civilizations themselves and that could, to a limited degree, also connect these civilizations. Not surprisingly, in this context, the classical period offers our first stories of great interregional travelers. Undoubtedly, such travelers had existed before. Remember, the human species was a migratory species. We just don't have records, and we don't know how far any given individual wandered. But in this period, among other things, the first great Greek traveler, Herodotus, the 5th century Greek, managed to write down his travel stories. And they reveal an active imagination, an active curiosity about distant places, a considerable tolerance for habits that he discovered that were different from those of Greece, all of the apparatus that one would expect and hope from a person whose travels reflected the extent to which the classical world was not entirely bound within severe limits. Herodotus also, however, illustrates some of the continuing limitations of interregional contacts. His travels took him to Egypt. His travels took him to parts of the Middle East. His travels took him at least toward the western reaches of Central Asia. But this is not a huge network. No reason to downplay him. It's very venturesome by the standards of the time. But by the standards that would be established by a next series of travelers in the next world history period, this is interesting, promising, but a little bit modest. Equally revealing was the extent to which Herodotus and some other early travelers or people who were echoing the comments of travelers, the extent to which Herodotus was willing to mix absolute fancifulness and nonsense with solid fact. He visited a number of societies. He often proved to be a good observer, but he was extremely credulous about what people told him about that society over the next hill. Particularly, he loved to exaggerate sexual peculiarities, anatomical peculiarities, and his mixture of sober account and invention reveals what might be argued to be a sort of logical first stage of interregional travel that matches the tentativeness of commercial outreach that we've already described. Other travelers developed later in the classical period, particularly important right at the end of the classical period, was a significant series of Chinese travelers moving into Central Asia and particularly into India, where they, among other things, often sought Buddhist sanctuary, Buddhist inspiration. These travelers would help expand Chinese knowledge of a world beyond Chinese boundaries and, again, illustrate the extent to which the classical world was not entirely confined to the major civilizations themselves. A second kind of contact, beyond travel and trade, emerged through two direct encounters between major civilizations themselves, and one might add a third. Encounter number one, reasonably well known, at least from the Greek standpoint in terms of Greek history, involved the encounter in the 6th and early 5th centuries BCE between Greece and Persia. Many Greeks learned quite a bit about Persian society. Some Greeks, like Herodotus, argued that Persians learned quite a bit about Greek society in what was a really unusual situation in which two major societies operating on somewhat different cultural and institutional bases had direct territorial and military interaction with each other, with some mutual learning resulting, and certainly a good bit of mutual antagonism. Beyond this, and in some ways extending it, Alexander the Great's conquest brought Greek civilization not only into more elaborate contact with societies and cultures in the Middle East, including Persia, but on into northwestern India. Here, emissaries from Hellenistic society, Greeks themselves, and other Middle Easterners who were interacting with Hellenistic values. Hellenistic representatives interacted directly with representatives of Indian culture with several interesting but arguably also surprisingly limited results. Most obvious was an artistic interaction that followed this period of Hellenistic Indian contact and lasted for probably about 150 years. In this contact, Greek artistic styles and costumes were utilized by Indian and Central Asian artists to represent, among other things, the figure of the Buddha and other figures associated with Buddhism. So there are interesting depictions of the Buddha with Greek hairstyles, Greek clothing styles, Greek artistic apparatus, and it's an intriguing example of the potency of contact in which two societies both maintain a certain degree of separation, i.e., these are Greek styles but Indian religion, but also manage to combine them in an imaginative combination or synthesis. Equally important, however, this stylistic fusion didn't last too long, doesn't have clear echo, because by the end of the Hellenistic period, this kingdom had dissolved, and the Greek-Indian interaction dissolved with it. Another facet of this interaction, which almost certainly occurred but we don't know full dimensions, involves the extent to which Greek and Indian mathematicians exchanged ideas. Both societies had developed advanced mathematics, each had a somewhat distinctive set of experiences, and as far as we can determine, there was some active interest on both parts in using this point of contact for what we might view as an early version of scientific exchange. On the other hand, not only is our knowledge of exactly what was passed around limited, but one of the most obvious, in retrospect, possibilities for transmission did not occur. Greeks did not pick up through this conversation the Indian number system, which was vastly superior to the Greek system and which would be adopted in the West only after it had much later been transmitted to the Arabs and thence to the Western world. So again, patterns here seem to be interesting, intriguing, but surprisingly limited, suggesting that even when two civilizations encountered each other directly, there was some hesitation about borrowing too much. Other possible results of this Greek-Indian interaction include the possibility that it was Alexander's inspiration, his intrusion politically and militarily into India, that helped inspire later Indian leaders to begin greater political and imperial activity on their own, leading initially to the Mauryan dynasty, the first great Indian imperial episode. That's an interesting possible ramification, but not exactly a connection in the sense of active ongoing contact or imitation. It's also possible that fueled by this contact, some Buddhist missionaries were sent into the Middle East, where possibly, although they did not seem to generate many, if any, direct conversions to Buddhism, possibly there was some interaction with Middle Eastern thinking, Middle Eastern ethical thought, in ways that would later fuel Western movements like Stoicism, and through them even possibly some aspects of Christianity. But this is speculative. We simply don't have the records. We don't know how far to press this contact. A final contact, and a much better established one, we know more about it among other things, a final contact began to take shape in the early centuries CE directly between China and India. Chinese merchants obviously had developed interest in Indian connections. Chinese travelers began to report not just on Indian religion, but on the prosperity of Indian society. And a fairly steady trickle of Chinese visitors began to pour down into the subcontinent from the 2nd and 3rd centuries CE onward. From their activities, and sometimes as a direct intention behind their activities, China began to import Buddhism directly from India, along with Buddhist artistic styles, Buddhist literature, in a pattern of exchange, a really unusual pattern of exchange for the classical period that ushered in a significant alteration in Chinese history for several centuries. This actually, until the past century plus, is the only significant case of fairly deliberate and extensive Chinese involvement with a foreign cultural import in ways that would interact with the Chinese mainstream. Large numbers of upper class and ordinary Chinese converted to Buddhism, interest in replicating Buddhist prayers, in translating Buddhist religious literature, ran high in China, and it's an intriguing episode. Also intriguing, and this frankly is not a qualification on the importance of this contact, also intriguing is the extent to which the contact had to be mediated by a corresponding effort to make sure that the Buddhism that was imported in ways that were consistent with Chinese value systems. Two points of sinification of making Buddhism Chinese were particularly significant. First, Chinese insistence helped persuade many Buddhist leaders in China of the importance of combining their genuine Buddhism with a very explicit acknowledgement of the importance of the Chinese state and the legitimacy of the Chinese emperor. In other words, Buddhism by Chinese values, particularly Confucian values, could seem slightly risky if it was allowed to retain its emphasis on purely religious goals, on otherworldly contemplation, and it could be brought into greater harmony if some explicit statements of political loyalty could be added in. The other adjustment is actually in many ways more intriguing, not less expected, but more intriguing. That was the extent to which, under Chinese influence, the Buddhism that flowed into China was modified to place greater emphasis on what today we might call family values. Buddhism, in its pure form, valued celibacy. Buddhism tended to emphasize individual spiritual quests in which the family might be deliberately downplayed or even abandoned. And this did not sit well with the Confucian view of social propriety. So many Buddhist statements about women, about family obligations, were significantly redone in the effort to make this pattern more recognizable, more harmonious with Chinese values. This is an indication, obviously, that exchanges between civilizations were going to be complicated, which is totally unsurprising. It's an indication that serious exchanges, and this was one, serious exchanges would involve what we sometimes call symbiosis, that is, a combination of the imported value system with important beliefs and practices from the receiving society in a syncretic fashion. This is an illustration, then, of a kind of combination that during the classical period itself was frankly fairly rare. What does this add up to? The stories are intriguing. Herodotus is a really interesting traveler. His account is well worth reading, both the accurate parts and the fanciful parts. The stories of the Silk Road trade are endlessly enthralling because, again, they're shrouded in mystery. They cover long distances. They cover societies in which civilization and nomadism intermingle to a certain extent. All of this is great stuff. But as I've tried to indicate, it's important to realize that for the classical period itself, these patterns of contact and exchange were not peripheral, but minor chord in the history of the period itself. The basic stuff of classical history continues to be the focus on the individual civilizations, the areas immediately around them that they could affect through trade patterns and cultural exchanges, but not any sort of systematic interaction among the civilizations themselves. It's important to recognize that for most of the classical civilizations during most of the period, direct borders with other large organized civilizations were the exception rather than the rule. Greece abutted Persia. The expanded Roman Empire would also contact later Persian kingdoms and war with them. That was an active intercivilizational border. Persia and Indian kingdoms might have some direct contact in a familiar kind of geographical passage. But large stretches of the Roman Empire bordered on hunting and gathering or early agricultural societies, not on highly organized civilizations. Most of China's borders, with the exception of Korea and Vietnam, similarly involve contacts with nomadic peoples, not those of other civilizations. And the same applies to much of India. Classical history, obviously, remains a history in which contacts are an important but secondary story, despite our tendency to wish that they somehow counted for more. That said, I'll back up just briefly to insist as well that though the contacts were somewhat marginal in terms of the leading economic themes of the period within the major regions, although with the exception really of the Chinese-Indian exchange, they didn't generate deep or durable cultural influences that touched more than one society, although they didn't clearly develop patterns of technological diffusion that were particularly extraordinary, the exchanges were significant enough that they would be remembered even after some of the apparatus of the classical period itself fell into disuse. The Silk Roads particularly had depended, obviously, on effective Chinese control of a territory that reached into Central Asia. They depended on some capacity to protect at least some of the traders and travelers along the Central Asian route. They depended very heavily on the significant organization of Persia that was first obtained in the Persian Empire and then revived by successor states, because utilizing the Persian road system, utilizing the system of inns and places of refuge that the Persian government had built, was a vital land route connection between Central Asia and the Middle East and on into the Mediterranean. So these routes were important, they were well established, and as they began to be challenged, they would be remembered and ultimately replacements would be sought. For the final stage of the story, in the classical period itself, is to recognize that as the classical societies began to decline, to suffer new levels of disorder, and that's the subject of our next session, familiar but in world history somewhat transformed account of the rise and fall of, as these organized classical civilizations began at least for a time to disintegrate, the importance of trade opportunities, and possibly even the promise of cultural exchange, remained vivid enough that people would actively seek replacements. And if the land route that had, for example, anchored the Silk Roads, if the land route became impassable, if government authority became too weak and enfeebled to guarantee the security of travelers around this route, there was, frankly, a pretty obvious alternative already sketched in the classical period itself, and that would be further, wider utilization of the Indian Ocean, a replacement, at least for a time, a replacement of land-based operations with sea trade, and that would help indeed usher in some key characteristics of the next period. So, the contact points in the classical period, well worth noting, they're an important if subsidiary part of the classical story. They don't overwhelm the greater dominance of factors operating within the civilizations, but they add a bit. But they did help set up a phase in which, in succeeding centuries after the classical period, new types of contact would be pursued, new levels of contact would develop, and the story would really take on a different coloration entirely.